The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here. We have a short agenda. First of all, well, we can't do the approval of the minutes because we don't have a quorum yet, but we do have an administrative quorum, and
so
we are.
We can do minutes.
Okay. So, does anybody want to make a motion to?
Madam Chair, I'd make a motion to approve the minutes from the March 14th, 2017 meeting.
Thank you very much, Senator Jasinski. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And I think we're going to go ahead and start with number four, Senator Miller, because he has testifiers that have come from a long ways away. And I did see him in the room.
Good
Welcome,
evening,
Senator Miller.
Madam Chair and members, it's good to be in the Pensions Commission tonight.
Glad we got you in. It's a great, great commission.
All right. Madam Chair and members, I have Joe Reed with me, who is the Student Union and Activities Director at Winona State University. And rather than me get into the details of what we're proposing, I think it might be best for Mr. Reed to explain the situation that he's in, and then I can certainly follow up or we can answer questions.
Well, thank you, Senator Miller. Which I think I might do is have Ms. Barth explain this bill first.
That would
be
wonderful.
And then we'll turn over to Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Senate File 1839 allows Mr. Reed to elect retroactive and prospective TRA coverage rather than his current coverage under the IRAP plan, which is administered by Minnesota State. Mr. Reed should have been offered an election option back in 1995, but he states that he was never provided any information about the election, and Minnesota State can neither confirm nor deny that Mr. Reed was provided that information. So the bill puts Mr. Reed in the place he would have been had he been provided the election option. And Mr. Reed must repay an MSRS refund and any additional employee contributions, and then Minnesota State must repay any remaining balance of the total actuarial value of the election that is left over after the appropriate transfer of funds from Mr. Reed's IRAP account to TRA, and after, of course, Mr. Reed pays the additional employee contributions.
Questions for Ms. Barth?
Any questions for Ms. Barth? Welcome, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, I might be able to wait until Mr. Reed's done.
Okay.
I just wanted to do a little more backgrounding, and maybe he'll get to it as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joseph Reed, and I work at Winona State. I've been there 28 years. Originally, I was a state auditor with the Minnesota Department of Economic Security back in 1981, and then I was offered the position at Winona State in 89. It was a clean, not even a day went by between going from one job to the other. I was in the MSRS system at that time, and I'm not a retirement guru, so I just assumed that I would have been put into the system and did my job. And then, as you get up in years, you try and find, when you get close to this time, you want to figure out what's going on, looking ahead. And it's when I found out that I had another option, but I didn't get it back in 1994.
Senator Miller, any other comments?
No other comments, Mr. Chair.
Right, members, questions for Senator Miller or Mr. Reed at this time? I will follow up with a question that I had. And Ms. Barth, the question that I have is, the employment that Mr. Reed had, we had MSRS, we have TRA, and we have the IRAP. The question I have is, what position that he holds makes him eligible for TRA? So we have very, very few people in the MNSCU system that are participating in TRA.
Representative O'Driscoll, so back in 1994, a law was passed that gave sort of a window for certain employees working for Minnesota State the option to elect TRA coverage. And in my memo, I think it's... So it allows individuals who were covered by IRAP as of July 1, 1994, who were first employed after June 30th, 1989, within the Minsky system, to make a one-time irrevocable retirement coverage election switch from IRAP to TRA. And Mr. Reed fits that eligibility. So that was that short little window that he had the option.
Ms. Barth, I guess another question that I have on the on this idea as well is, do we have anybody from MnSKU here today to talk about or to address the error that might have occurred on their end and any costs that would be associated with the for MnSKU and for lack of a better term, do we have the equivalence of a fiscal note as to what that cost would be?
Representative O'Driscoll, so Derek Hughes from Minnesota State's here, and then if you look on page 2, number 3 of my memo, you'll see the costs.
Very good. Good evening. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Derek Hughes. I'm the System Director for Compensation and Retirement with Minnesota State. And to answer the questions, as Ms. Barr stated, yes, Mr. Reed was eligible in an unclassified position to elect either the IRAP or TRA. He had 90 days to make that decision, and we do not have a form indicating that we made that offer to him. We cannot prove that that was provided. The cost to repaying the MSRS, as Ms. Barth indicated on the second page, is approximately around $118,000 that Mr. Reed would have to pay before any rollover of his funds could occur. And then at that time, Mr. Reed would owe just under $40,000 of additional contributions plus interest. Minnesota State would owe an additional about $6,000 for a total of approximately $45,000 to $46,000. And afterwards, after rolling over all of his IRAP contributions, Winona State would owe $160,534. And based on some data that could fluctuate with market validation.
And Winona State is ready to make that, make him whole on this?
Mr. Chair, yes, provided the bill is passed.
They would follow. And Mr. Reed, question for you.
Yes, sir.
You are also realizing your obligation that would be on here as well, correct?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
And Mr. Reed, I sound like Senator Pappas because she's the one who's not here who usually asks these questions of folks in the commission. But you also realize that this is not this is enabling language and not prescriptive. It does not require you to go forward with this. It only makes the option available to you, and that if you choose not to, to within the times and confines of the bill and the time frame set forth, that you would lose that opportunity.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Members, other questions? Senator Janiseski, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And being new to the committee, has this been done before? Has it gone back that far? Is this something that happens occasionally? I just kind of get a little bit of a history on an item like this.
The simple answer is yes. I'll let Ms. Barth give you more background on that, Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jasinski, yes, typically every session we have about one or two individual constituent bills that deal with this issue. And I've actually, so the way that this bill is drafted is modeled off of a past bill that dealt with this similar issue, so there is a precedent.
Senator Pappas, for your reference, I asked all the questions we usually ask on this topic related to who's paying, how much. Do you understand that this is prescriptive and not, or enabling and not prescriptive legislation, and understand the dollars and cents for a buyback? So,
Mr. Chairman, you caught me with the apple in my mouth.
Sorry, but I wanted to let you know that the tag team that we've done in the past on this is alive and well this session as well. Seeing no other member questions, and I don't think there's anyone else who needs to testify on the matter, Senator Miller will give you a chance to wrap up if there's any thoughts that you want the commission to know at this time.
Mr. Chair and members, just thank you for hearing this legislation, and I just ask for a favorable vote so we can do what's right for Mr. Reed and give him this opportunity to get in the right plan.
Senator Miller, I'm going to lay this matter over till a little bit later this evening and see how the chair wants to proceed with this upon her return. So, Senator Miller, Mr. Reed, thank you, and thank you as well for your time here this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
The next item that we're going to do, and we're kind of going reverse order, Representative Thiessen, I'm going to have you do. You. Okay, that's fine. Sure, sure. Representative Simonson, if you want to come, or excuse me. Well. We'll let the member from Duluth go forward. Representative Thiessen. We'll let the member from Duluth. Senator Simonson, welcome to the committee. You and Representative Murphy have a bill that you'd like us to consider this evening. I'll give you an opportunity if you'd like to introduce the bill, or if you want us to go to staff and then back to you. It's your preference. Senator Simonson, how would you like us to proceed on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And with the chair's indulgence, I would like to just go over it quickly myself. If you could perhaps consider the 1A amendment to get it in the shape I would like it in.
At this time, Representative Simonson, we don't have a quorum to be able to affect that. So we can certainly make a note that that is your wishes and intentions. And here comes our number four in-person member, so we can make that happen for you. Right. I just know that last year we had a question by one of the members when someone had stepped out. So I just didn't want to have that same thing happen perhaps on a bill that member was bringing forward. So with that, Representative Simonson, I will move the A1 amendment to House file or Senate file. Well, I guess it's House file is what I have in my folder here. I've got the wrong one.
Should be a Senate file, Mr. Chair.
I don't work well with Senate files, sorry.
Right.
Here we go. All right, to the A1 amendment to Senate file 1864. I'll move the amendment. All those in favor of getting the bill in the shape the author wishes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative, now Senator Simonson, to the bill in the order that you'd like it. Don't change chambers on us. It really creates some problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know that there's many other places that I could go where we would get confused, but I do answer to most anything. Now, I want to appreciate, first of all, the opportunity for you to hear this bill. It's relatively simple, but yet it's complicated and it requires a little bit of explanation as to how we got to this point. The amendment that you just adopted is based on a number of discussions with a number of folks trying to get to a point where everybody was comfortable with the bill, and I hope that as we go through the rest of the testimony that we learn that everyone is at least neutral on the bill. But essentially, I just ask you to consider the following scenario. If you have a public employee that is a member of PERA, and during the time that they're an active employee, of course, they're making contributions into PERA, contributions based on a percentage of their salary earned, and of course, the employer is making their share of the contribution as well. The scenario that I want to set up is one where an employee is hurt at work, injured or receives an illness that is directly related to their line of work, and they're off on a worker's comp. And as you know, I'm sure, once the work comp has been approved and the employee is off, a portion of their salary is paid by the work comp provider, and the employer picks up the balance. So for round numbers, we'll say the employee was making $1,000 a week prior to the injury at work. And then after work comp kicks in and the employee is off work, let's say just for round numbers, $300 of it is being picked up by the work comp provider. The remaining $7 continues to be paid by the employer. Under current law, the PERA contributions are paid by the employer and the employee on the $700. The $300 that the work comp provider is picking up, there is no automatic contribution by either the employee or the employer into PERA. Now, I find that is inherently wrong, and I think that the thing that I'm trying to resolve with this bill recognizes that in the event that a PERA member who is an active employee gets hurt at work and is receiving work comp dollars, that there is a mechanism for them to purchase get purchase credit for their salary and bring in the employer to that equation. So current law says that if I'm this person that gets hurt and I'm off work, I can elect under current law to make my employee contribution voluntarily, and I can do that. Current law also says that I can elect as the employee to pay the employer's contribution if I would choose to do so. Now, you may ask yourself, why on earth would you do that? If you happen to be an employee that is in, towards the tail end of your career, it may benefit you to have those salary dollars counted as actual credit, salary credit, under PERA, in calculation of your retirement. If you are early in your career, your first 5-10 years, obviously you would never elect to do that. But the current law says that I can voluntarily do that, and it also says I can voluntarily pay the employer's contribution. Law also says that if the employer elects to, it doesn't say they have to, but it says that they may elect to, by resolution passed, pay the employer's share on those work comp dollars. In other words, the employer's percentage on that $300 that I talked about. This bill, the way it's written and the way it's drafted, we believe, changes that scenario and says that in the event that the employee elects to pay their own employee contribution into PERA, the employer is mandated to follow suit and pay their fair share, of the contribution. And all I'm really trying to say is that in the event that an employee is hurt at work in the course of their employment, that their PERA contributions and their salary credit continue to stay whole in the event the employee chooses to make the payment. If I, as the employee, elect not to make my contributions, there's nothing in this bill that would mandate the employer to do anything. So it essentially leaves the decision with the employee if they choose to make those payments. This bill would provide an opportunity for the employer to make their payments. They wouldn't have a choice. It would be mandated by law. This bill, with the amendment that you adopted, is strictly to PERA. We had considered including a number of the other plans just to try to create some uniformity, but I think we've got some more work to do with some of the other plans, and we'll continue to do that into the future. So this bill is a little bit narrowed in scope. So there should be a handout in your packet that shows an email from para staff or from staff about what the impact of this actually means, and there's an attached spreadsheet. And I think if you look at the second paragraph of that email, it really kind of highlights and articulates what the impact of this bill will be. And it essentially says, because we were trying to figure out what the impact of this would be, it essentially says that during a 5-year period from 2012 to 2016, we know that there were approximately 1,100 leaves due to work comp reported by employers. And this is statewide PERA. Of that 1,100 leaves, 38 were paid under current law. In other words, 38 times out of 1,100, that employee that was affected elected to make their voluntary contributions. Of the 38, 6 times, the employer, I would say, did the right thing and stepped up and made their contributions on the work comp portion of the salary that was paid. So this bill, had it been in place, it would affect, essentially 32 cases, in theory, over the last 5 years. The point being, members, is that this, again, it's not going to have a huge impact to employers. I think that you'll read here that there is an estimated annual cost to all para employers across the state of just over $8,000. And that's certainly not per employer. It is total cost spread across all the employers that would be affected. And again, I don't, in anticipation of some of the questions that have come up, I wouldn't anticipate that there's going to be a rush of these. I think, again, keep in mind that if for the employee that gets hurt at work and is considering whether or not they want to purchase these salary credits, it really depends on where you're at in your career. There are certain points in your career where it makes sense to do this, and there are many more points in your career where it would make no sense to do this. So that is as brief an explanation as I can give, Mr. Chair and members. I know that we have some testifiers that want to speak to the bill, and then I think if there are technical questions, we certainly have staff available to do that.
Thank you, Senator Simonson. Before we do move to the other testifiers, Ms. Lincheski, Ms. Barth, which of the two of you is handling this? Ms. Lincheski, if you want to background the commission from a staff and technical standpoint, if there's anything you would like to add at this point.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I think the only thing I would add is that, as Senator Simonson mentioned, it would have made sense, I think, from a uniformity point of view to apply this across the board. In talking, though, with the plans after this legislation was introduced, there seems to be some willingness on the part of the teachers' retirement to move in this direction, but there would need to be some implementation time, which makes sense because they need to gather information from all the school districts across the state on this point. With regard to MSRS, we discovered that MSRS is giving credit without any employee or employer contributions being made. So there is definitely a difference in treatment among the plans. So MSRS is definitely the outlier on that. So as Senator Simonson suggests, we probably have a little work to do if we want to look at whether that is, you know, the direction we want to go is with respect to the pension plans generally on this topic.
Ms. Lincheski, the obvious question that I have is we've had a number of work comp claims in the past. The hypothesis that's being put forward by Senator Simonson certainly has some merit for discussion. Why are we having this discussion in 2017 instead of 2007 or 2097? Do you have any background as to why we might not have brought this up forward until today?
Representative O'Driscoll, I don't have any idea. I think there was a constituent, perhaps, that came to Senator Simonson and noted this, and I think there's then some action to that issue, and it makes a lot of sense, I think, to bring it up now, even though this has existed for some time.
Very good. Members, questions at this time of staff or Senator Simonson before we bring testifiers forward? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious why this has not been part, or has this been part of labor negotiations, or if not, why not, or is there some reason that you could tell me?
Senator Simonson, do you want to take that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I, you know, having negotiated public employees' contracts for a number of years, this is not the type of item that would typically come up in negotiations, and I can honestly tell you in 25 plus years, it never has come up in negotiations. And quite frankly, if it did, I would suggest that this is where it belongs in law and not necessarily a term and condition of employment. But that, of course, is open to interpretation. But it has just honestly not come up before to me.
Thank you.
Other member questions at this time? Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee this evening, sir. State your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm looking at the timing of the contributions, and I'm just wondering, I'm just trying to be clear in terms of when that contribution would be made into. Is it concurrent with the disability, or is it only can be made at the completion of the disabling injury?
Senator Simonson.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll defer to staff. I think I certainly have the answer in my head, but let's get an answer from staff to be clear.
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you. Representative Albright, the ability to pay comes at the end of the period of leave. So when they return to employment, for instance, there is a year during which they can make the employee and employer contribution. If they don't return to work, they have 30 days to make that contribution payment.
Representative Albright, follow-up.
Yes, thank you. Senator, and this is purely maybe my eclectic nature, but on subdivision 2 where it says purchase procedure on page 7, in line 7.7, it says for any period of leave. I'm just wondering if there's any conflict there with regard to what happens if a disabling injury or on-the-job injury only takes 6 weeks or 4 weeks and then comes back? How do we determine the timing on something like that, where it's obviously we're glad to have the worker back, but is that still applicable to this type of an issue?
Senator Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, good question, but Section 3 is one of the sections that we deleted with the original amendment. Just so everybody's aware, we're just focusing on Section 2 of the bill, the original bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other member questions before we take testifiers? Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to play freshman ignorance here and use maybe a bad example. But say, for example, and as a mayor of Faribault, I was there for 8 years and had employees. And if someone in their last 5 years of work, and I'll say conveniently, gets hurt on the job, and they want to contribute to their retirement for the last 5 years and put their money in, there's really no incentive for them to get off workman's comp if they just want to finish out their 5 years as not working and collect and then have their employee contribute to that. Can you, and this is a worst case example, don't get me wrong, it happens all the time, but I want to know what would happen in this instance. If someone was in the last 5 years of employment and they conveniently got hurt at work and they have no incentive to get off comp, and they're paying their last 5 years as their employee contribution, but their employer then is required to pay their last, could be 5 years. So could you just comment on that and how that would affect?
Senator Simonson.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I two things. First of all, the bill limits this to 12 months. So that would be a worst case scenario, I suppose, from an employer perspective. I would also suggest that, you know, your question is well taken, and I think it's a great question for the Work Comp Commission. But I know Work Comp providers, there's very little opportunity to fool a Work Comp provider in this day and age. But I think we tried to address that concern by limiting it to 1 year available for purchase, or up to a maximum of 1 year, I should say.
Ms. Lincheski, I'm going to ask you to comment on this. If someone, as the senator has pointed out in his scenario, is on work comp for 5 years, there might have been a disability hearing, and that person might have been moved from active to disability benefits under PERA. Would I be right in that assumption?
Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that is true. So the other thing that the bill does is there is a mention of temporary workers' compensation payments in Section 2 here, and the amendment also adds in temporary, so instead of permanent workers' comp, this is only applicable to the case of temporary. I think that is probable that if it was a disability case, it may not ever come up in a temporary workers' comp situation, but it's true. I think that could convert to a disability benefit.
I bet you we can ask Ms. Jones that question when she comes up. Which, speaking of testifiers, let's have Ms. Jones come up. Good evening and welcome to the commission. Please state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Shana Jones, Policy Director, PERA. Senator Simonson actually did a great job summarizing the bill and all of the provisions for it. So I'll only add that PERA does not oppose the bill. We still come out with the same dollars at the end of the day, so financially there's not an impact to us. And then the other component that's of interest to us is administrative, and we already have the systems in place to bill employers for additional payments, and so this would only require minor changes in our processes.
Ms. Jones, to Senator Jasinski's question and my comments on that, were we on the right track perhaps with my assertion that an individual might move from worker comp to a permanent disability status if it lasted as long as the senator was indicating?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jasinski, so I assume you're talking about a para-disability benefit. That happens sometimes, and in our administrative bill from last year, we tried to put something in there that says that they can still make the payment if they go on a disability benefit. So let's say they're on a workers' compensation leave of absence, and they're not able to return to their job, and they end up receiving a para-disability benefit, they have 30 days to make that payment. And that would influence how that disability benefit is calculated, of course.
Okay. Questions of Ms. Jones? Seeing no, I just ask you to stand by in case there are some questions, and I'll ask Mr. Flaherty to come forward at this time as well, followed by Mr. Brian Rice. Mr. Flaherty, welcome to the commission. If you'll state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dennis Flaherty with the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, representing about 8,500 police officers that work throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm here tonight to speak in support of this bill because, as you can imagine, a fair number of police officers and firefighters do, in fact, sustain injuries while working and end up away from their jobs while recovering. During that time, they are, of course, receiving workers' compensation benefits. I've been told that of PERA members, about 25% are cops, that cops and firefighters that do, in fact, end up going out on a workers' comp leave. The pensions of employees that have a leave covered by workers' comp can be negatively impacted by the negatively impacted if the member misses full months of service or receives reduced salary. Clearly, they should not be punished or have their pensions harmed due to work-related issues. The employer would have otherwise had to pay their portion of the contributions if the member was not injured at work. So we kind of look at this as really a fairness issue. Public safety personnel are more likely to be on leave, and when they are, they make a payment to restore missed contributions. So we have a history of doing that anyhow. So we think that this bill is fair and is necessary, and that employers should be expected to pay their share along with the police or firefighter.
Members, questions for Mr. Flaherty? Again, we'll ask you to kind of hang by in case there are. Mr. Rice, we'll go to you, and then Mr. Gary Carlson will be our next testifier. Mr. Rice, good evening. State your name for the record and who you represent. Proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. That's a group of 1,800 professional firefighters in 43 cities around the state. And we do support Senator Simonson's bill. Maybe just to quickly answer a couple questions that have come up from Pension Commission members. To your question, Representative O'Driscoll, why didn't this come up sooner? I think we are a key part of that amendment reinserted the word temporary on page 4.15. And so we're talking about a pretty narrow set of circumstances, as was pointed out by Senator Simonson in response to Senator Jasinski's question about why not 5 years. We're really talking about just a 12-month period where some member had a temporary disability or was on workers' compensation for a very short period of time. And the question is, how would you restore that last time in terms of pension purposes? And it is very important, as Senator Simonson said, you could have somebody who's in maybe their last 5 years of employment. Their injury could cause them very long-term diminution of their pension value because of an on-duty injury. And that's why I think we're talking about this circumstance. Senator Dames, you asked the question about why didn't this ever come up in labor negotiations. Under PELRA, you cannot bargain pensions in collective bargaining. That's a fair question because it's kind of an obscure area of law. To that point, this is a pretty important provision. As I've testified before, for a good part of my career, I worked with the local police and fire relief associations in cities throughout the state, and they had a provision called injured on duty. And if you were in one of the old relief associations, I think Senator Simonson actually was for some point in his career, was familiar with members like that. Those old police and fire laws actually had an affirmative duty that when a police or firefighter was injured on duty, they had to be given less hazardous duty pay. In other words, the city kept them on the department and found a job for them in somewhere in the organization. and that was only for people who were temporarily disabled that could still perform some functions, but maybe they couldn't ride the rig or be in the police star. They give them the property room assignment. They would give them an assignment to work with fire safety education. And so these issues never came up because it was just assumed they would be given a job or their pension would not suffer any diminution in value. Several years back, and again, just in the police and fire area, we advocated, unsuccessfully, I might add, that that injured on duty temporary IOD be extended to all PRA members because there was this problem about what would happen. The coverage for a disability pension was adequate, but how do you deal with these temporary circumstances? So I would say, going back to your question, Representative O'Driscoll, why hasn't this come up? It's a not a frequently occurring situation. In the past, if you were in police and fire in the old relief associations, you'd be covered because the policy was if an employee was injured in the course and scope of their employment while on duty, the employer would make them whole. And we think that that's a fair policy, and we think that's exactly what Senator Simonson's bill would do. And we think it's the right policy that if an employee is injured, why should they suffer an economic loss that otherwise isn't made up? So I think that that's why the bill has come before you. It would probably, as Senator Simonson indicated, at least from what I've seen in the research memos, only touch certain members. And we think it does make sense as a pension policy to cover this cohort of people who were injured only temporarily. So it could be up to a month, 12 months, but it might be if I'm injured, broke my leg, it takes me 2 months to get back in shape, I come back, and you know the payment's made, there's been no loss in terms of the economic impact to me long-term for a pension.
Members, questions for Mr. Rice? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I don't mean to belittle this point, but any employee that's hurt actually on the job and it's a real claim, I have no problem compensating. It's the false claims that I saw in my tenure as the mayor that you know they were not legitimate. And if in this case, if you had an employee that hurt themselves and was compensated by workman's comp for 6 months, came back on for a month and then got hurt again and then went and collected, that's the only person I want to protect again, or that I think the employer needs to be protected again. Again, if someone is legitimately hurt at work, I have no problem. I agree with it 100%. It's the false claims or the repetitive claims, and maybe there's a way that you can put something or something in this bill that if it's a continual problem or you see something like that, because it's happened. I can give it an exact example. I'm not going to do it here, but there are examples of people that have false claims, and it's a routine thing that just keeps happening. And they're just trying to get by those last couple years. So that's my concern, and I don't know how we can address that. But it does happen out there, I will tell you that.
Mr. Rice.
Just a brief response, Mr. Chair, Senator Jasinski. I'm most familiar with the area in police and fire, and I know it was probably back in 2007 or 8, there was a major redo of the para-police and fire law. To deal with the concerns, exactly as you're saying, that there was alleged abuse of retirement benefits or people seeking to get pension out basically on a disability pension, and those laws were really really tightened up so much to the point that we were able to come back and make some changes. I think from at least the police and fire side, we would say in our case that if anything, the law went too far the other way. And we'd still feel that to this day, but, you know, the Pension Commission made a decision on that. People have to live with it. I guess I think that Representative Senator Simonson said that I would submit becomes a matter of enforcement then. I mean, for cities or other people, if people aren't really injured, they shouldn't be entitled to these kinds of benefits. The benefits are there if people cannot perform their job. And the pensions are there if you were loyal, faithful, true, and you performed the service, you ought to get what you thought was promised. And if there's an intervening injury that's hurting you, that's what I think Senator Simonson's trying to do with this bill.
Senator, follow-up? Members, other questions for Mr. Rice? Thank you, Mr. Rice. I'll have you hang by in case there are other questions. And we'll call up Mr. Gary Carlson and Mr. Keith Carlson as well. Mr. Gary Carlson, if you'll introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Senator Simonson for meeting with us to discuss this bill and try to understand its implications. And I also want to thank PERA for analyzing some of the information for the last 5 years worth of workers' compensation claims and how they experience might be affected if this law were in place over the last 5 years. Based upon our reading of the bill, we think that the impacts of this change would be there would be some impacts, but it would not be substantial impacts on any employer. But I do want to say that when we change the law, the data that we received from PERA will likely change because there is now a new provision in law that says employers must pay the share. But what I'd like to do is reserve the right to continue to work with Senator Simonson and the Pension Commission to more fully understand how this may play out. But at this time, we're not opposed. We're not supporting this bill, but we have vetted it, and we think the impacts would be not substantial for our city employers. Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Carlson. Seeing none and hearing none, Mr. Hilgert, are you going to testify as well?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I just wanted to echo the
points made.
I'll state
your name if you would for the record and who you represent.
Yes, thank you. Sorry about that. My name is Matt Hilgert. I represent the Association of the Minnesota Counties. Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'll be very brief and echo the same points that Mr. Gary Carlson said. First, thanking Senator for reaching out to us on this issue proactively and having us in his office just this week to talk about the issue. As Mr. Carlson mentioned, we do not believe the frequency will be that high that it will indicate a major cost at this time. We don't think that it will be 38 cases in what I believe that was 5 years or 4 years. We do think it might have the chance to increase, but we don't think that it will be prohibitively expensive for employers at this time. We are encouraged by the uniformity of kind of treatment of injuries. We do believe that is interesting to look at in terms of pension policy. However, as Mr. Carlson noted, as this goes forward, we will have to reserve the right for future comments if we are seeing a huge influx of cases coming forward. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Hilgert? Members, seeing none, hearing none, Mr. Keith Carlson, if you'll introduce yourself, will you represent and proceed with your testimony, please?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties in greater Minnesota and 4 here in the metropolitan area. I also have three other counties that participate in our HR committee who I've circulated this document to. I do have to indicate my substantial concern with this provision because of the material changes that have occurred since I last discussed it and exchanged emails with the PERA Pension Commission staff and Senator Simonson, and that issue relates to the issue of consistency. Principle for us is that all of the statewide pension systems should be treated the same, and with the amendment on lines 1.8, that is no longer the case. I do feel it necessary to go through some of the issues that have been raised here. First, there's been a characterization that this is creating equity between those individuals who receive injuries on the job versus off the job. While that is true for the short period that an individual has sick leave or vacation leave or paid time off, there's never an instance where an individual is receiving vacation sick leave for an entire year, as this bill would provide for the purchase back. I'll further go on. Mr. Rice brought up the issues that pensions cannot be negotiated. That's true, but wage differentials can be negotiated. So collective bargaining agreements could provide for a wage differential for an individual who is receiving partial disability payments. And we frankly believe that is the appropriate venue for doing this. That already occurs at some counties. For example, Ramsey County will allow the individual who is receiving workers' comp to exhaust his or her sick leave, paid time off, vacation leave. And then in addition, under their various collective bargaining agreements, there may be sick leave banks in some instances. That sick leave can also be used to maintain a level of pay consistent with what they were receiving before injury, and consequently they suffer no loss during that period. I finally just want to indicate the concern about the additional cost to employers under this bill. Already for an individual who is receiving workers' comp, we are either paying that directly if we're self-insured or we're paying for the insurance premium. We are likely paying overtime or replacement pay to an individual who's performing the work that that individual cannot pay. And, you know, I'll just finally speak to the issue of workers' comp, visas, PERA, disability pension. At least some of the members are aware of the fact that under a court case of several years ago, you can receive both workers' comp and PERA disability. The prior law that PERA disability offset the workers' comp benefit no longer exists. So you receive both under current law. So again, due to the material change in this amendment since I last discussed it with Senator Simonson and the staff, I respectfully must oppose it. Again, I thank the staff as well as Senator Simonson for giving us a heads up on it. But again, there have been changes since we last discussed this.
Members, any questions for Mr. Keith Carlson? Seeing none, is there anyone else present tonight who'd like to speak on the matter before the commission? Senate File 1864 as amended. Seeing none, Representative Simonson, I think what we're going to do with this, because by everyone's admission, there's some work that needs to be done. I think we'll lay this over, see if you can get some more work done on this before we consider putting it in the 2017 Omnibus Pension Bill. So we'll give you the last word before we do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to respond to a few of the things that Mr. Carlson said, because frankly, at this point, in terms of what you've amended and what you have before you, I don't know that there's any more work that we can do. I want to make the point very clear that we're trying to address a scenario where an employee is hurt at work. This is not an employee that's hurt off the job. It's an employee that's hurt in the course of employment. In the event the employee had not been hurt in the course of employment, the employer would be paying those very same PERA contributions throughout the course of the year. It's not the employee's fault if the employer chooses to backfill with overtime, et cetera, et cetera. These are dollars that were previously budgeted for this employee in terms of their PERA contributions. So I will tell you this, that the amendment that you offered is because of the concerns that were laid out, some of which were articulated by Mr. Carlson, especially with the provision on lines 4.15 in reinstating the word temporary. And I want to make it clear that this is a situation where we're talking about a maximum of 12 months salary credit purchase. And all we're asking is that in the event the employee elects to make that payment, the employer follows suit and does their fair share. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that. But thank you.
And with that, we'll lay over Senate File 1864 for possible inclusion. Madam Chair, as I turn the rest of the meeting back over to you, we did conclude our discussions on Senate File 1839. And I put it on the table because I'm not sure of the action that you wanted. So I will tell you that that is one pending action before we go to our next agenda item and defer to you how you'd like to handle that this evening.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Is there any questions on Senate File 1839, House File? There is no House File. Any questions on that? Because I think we will. Senator Pappas, move that bill.
Madam Chair, I did miss most of the conversation, but I read over the memo. And is the Senator Miller's, is the student, former student, Mr. Reed, is he intending, it's a huge payback number. Is he intending to pay that back? Did you talk to him about that?
I am not certain if Mr. Reed is still here, but maybe Ms. Barth can answer that question.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
when you came in, Senator Pappas, and I said I was asking the questions, those are literally the questions I was asking him.
Right.
Do you understand the dollar amount? Do you also understand right. that it's an obligation to pay it? You're not required to. This is enabling language. If you choose to go forward, it's not prescriptive. You don't have to. And then you'd have to abide by the terms of the window that were afforded in the bill. And he acknowledged that, as we've done
that
in the past
that.
On those kinds
okay.
of questions. So,
thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Ms. Barth. Do you have anything, any comments on that,
too? Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, no, he's aware of the numbers, and he seems to want to go forward with it. We showed him the numbers before the bill was introduced, and he still wants to go forward with it. So.
Further comments, questions? Senate Bill 1839? Would anybody like to move that bill? Representative O'Driscoll moves that Senate File 1839 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the Omnibus Pension Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Members, we also have House File 2236. Representative Thiessen, it's number three in your packet. Thank you, Representative Thiessen, for changing that up a little bit.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess do we move? I don't know, because the Senate does it differently. Do we move it now or after we?
You go ahead and explain, or we could have Ms. Lincheski explain the bill for you first, and then you can
move it later.
Bring in Mr. Anderson, if you'd like. Okay. Well, she's going to defer to you, Representative Thiessen.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, so House File 2236 deals with a group of firefighters and police officers who, over the course of many years, and I'll talk a little bit about the history of it, are now in a situation where they went along with a local plan, that they stayed with that as we consolidated and moved local plans into the statewide para police and fire fund, who are actually getting significantly lower pensions right now than their counterparts in para, police and fire. Starting in 1987, so going back 30 years, first of all, in 1980, the legislature said that no further police officers and firefighters could be in local plans. They all had to be in para, police, and fire. But, of course, there were many people that were already in the local plans that predated that. And these folks don't get Social Security. And so I think it's important for us to know that as well. So their entire pension is their pension. In 87, the legislature then started on a process of starting to consolidate these local plans. So every city, Minneapolis was the last one to go in along with Fairmont a few years ago. But every city, would have their own plan and fund it themselves and set their own rules. Starting in 87, they started to administratively consolidate these plans. So they didn't get incorporated into PARA, but they had PARA basically be the administrator. So PARA would have several, 45 different funds or 40 different funds that they managed. And over the last 30 years, then, the rules have changed quite a bit about the benefits that those officers who are in those and firefighters who were in those local plans would receive. Whenever that happened in 2010 or 2011, when Minneapolis and Fairmont consolidated into PARA, there are no local plans left, essentially. But the fact of the matter is that as a result of these changes over the last 30 years, and there were actually several times that the legislature acted, a number of unfair outcomes, I believe, resulted. And that's what this bill is trying to remedy. So the people that would be affected by this bill are firefighters and police officers who were hired before June 15th, 1980, or their surviving spouses. So that means that there's no one that's under the age of 60 affected by this legislation, and most of them, the retirees, are probably in their 70s, and I imagine that the surviving spouses are probably on average in their mid-80s. In 2014, the legislature directed PARA to prepare a study on this issue, which PARA did and made its report in January of 2015, which was I don't know if it's in the packet, but it is in the packet and was distributed earlier. So as of July 1st, 2014, which is the date that the report focused on, this legislation would have affected 83 retired police officers and firefighters. 66 of those 83 worked in greater Minnesota cities. At that time, their average life expectancy was about 15 years. The legislation would also affect about 288 surviving spouses. That number now is probably lower as well. The 83 and the 288, the retirees and the surviving spouses are probably lower now because some of these people have died since July of 2014. That includes well over 100 St. Paul surviving spouses, mainly widows, of police officers and firefighters. But again, the majority of them are from cities in greater Minnesota. And so what the bill does is it seeks to a modest increase in the pensions of those police and firefighters. And these are folks that have worked at least 20 years as well. So they started their service before 1980, and they had to have at least 20 years of service under those local plans, because back at that time, the vesting period for these pensions, unlike our pensions today, was 20 years. So you wouldn't actually qualify for the pension unless you had served 20 years. It would raise their pensions up to $38,000 or by 20%, whichever is less, for the retirees, and the bill would raise the widow's pension up to $30,000 a year or 20% above what they have now, whichever is less for those surviving spouses. And the cost, we just got the information here, is, it looks like, just under $8 million from the general fund to do that. And what the bill would do would be to spread that out over a 10-year period paid in from the state's general fund. I want to quote one thing from the report, because I think this puts things in perspective. One of the things about this bill is that, or about the changes that were made historically, are that if a police officer or a firefighter going into the fund chose para, police, and fire, their own benefits would increase according to the para benefits. And in the 90s, because the stock market did so well, they actually increased dramatically. But what we did when we passed the law back in the 80s and the 90s was to say, but once that officer dies and their surviving spouse is left, that surviving spouse drops back down to the level that they would have had under the local plan. And so Para noted, as an example, the degree to which the retiree benefits that increased under the post fund, which is what we used to have for Para, provisions came to bear no relationship to the eventual surviving spouse benefit can be seen from this example. At the time of his death, a retired police officer from a local plan who had received many of the para increases generated by the robust stock returns of the decade of the 1990s was just over $5,000 a month. So this person is making $60,000 a benefit a year. But once he died, using local plan survivor benefit calculation for the payment of the surviving spouse resulted in a benefit to the widow of $1,800 per month. So that widow, so when the officer died, the widow who had been, the couple who had been receiving $5,000 a month dropped $3,200 to $1,800 a month. And that, I think, captures pretty clearly the unfairness of where we are with these. And I think that the biggest issue to me are these widows generally, because they have had some very extreme reductions in benefits. Now, one other thing to remember is that after most of these changes that related to choosing benefits under the consolidation happened, we passed a law that required the spouse to sign off when the retiree was making a decision about their benefits, but these widows didn't have the benefit of that. So it was, you know, the retiree, was the man generally, was just making a decision about what these benefits were going to be without any input from his wife. And we have now changed that law, so I don't know that all of these decisions would have been the same had the widow actually been able to, or the wife at the time had been able to weigh in. So just a couple things, I guess, I would say about this. Para has a packet that they put together here, and if you look at what we're talking about, if you turn to page 2, I think everybody has this. So for surviving spouses, The average, you can see at the very bottom there, the average para police and fire survivor gets about close to $31,000 a month. And what we are asking for in this bill is to bring those widows up to either $30,000. For those widows that would only, remember it's $30,000 or 20% increase, whichever is less. For those that would only be eligible for the 20% increase, it's about $23,000. So these increases are bringing the surviving spouses up to about on par with where the average para police and fire surviving spouse is. And if you look above there, those who kind of, and that number is an average that includes those who aren't in this category, those folks, surviving spouses, get on average close to $39,000. So we're not asking for a really big increase. In fact, it's a below average pension after this bill would go into effect. And it's even more striking if you look at the retiree numbers, which is on page 3. For all para police and fire retirees and disabled pensioners, the average current benefit is $52,438. And again, we are looking at $38,000 for the benefit. That would be the cap. And for those who only qualify for the 20% increase, it would be back at about $27,000. So again, we are not asking, this bill is not asking even to get up to par or to the average benefit that people, that retirees in police and fire are at, but to at least get to a reasonable pension, again, for people that are not eligible for Social Security. And that, I think that's very significant. One other thing I think is noticed, and I think why this is consistent with how we've handled these consolidations and mergers of these local plans over the last 30 years, is to look at 1999. And that's when we forced consolidation. So instead of having all these independent plans administered by para, we basically said, all these people are just going to go into para, police and fire, into the main fund. And to do that, funds, local funds that had not fully funded their pension, which was most of them, had to pay in to make up that difference, which is how we always handled these, including when we did the Senator Rosen, when we did the Fairmont Minneapolis one. But what's significant about that is we actually didn't require those local communities to come up with the money. We used general fund money, state aid that went into para to do this. So essentially what we were doing at that time is saying we are going to, as a state, use our general fund to finance the benefits for these retirees because they were going to bring their benefits up to para, police, and fire. That is kind of the precedent we have already set in this context. And I think and remember that these local plans actually had a lesser benefit. So the state aid that we put in 1999 and onward through 2009 was lower because some of these folks selected to stay in their local plan. And so in the sense of bringing these local plans up to the para, police, and fire and not even up to that, we're just kind of finalizing the commitment we made back in 1999 to say the state is going to pick up the cost of these consolidations. So I actually think that we're not creating any precedent with this bill. I actually think that we are just fulfilling what we have already committed to do as a state over the last 30 years is use our state general fund to make sure that these retirees who are in these local plans, which we forced to consolidate into para, police, and fire, are fully funded and use our state general fund to do that. Again, it's about $1 million a year over the next 10 years, which isn't that big a price to pay from my perspective. And then I would just kind of end on this note. Setting all of that aside, you know, we use our general fund for all manner of subsidies for lots and lots of things. We use our general fund, our tax expenditure report is a perfect example of that, you know, for horses and for, you know, any number of things where we pick out individuals and say, we're going to help that individual group with our general fund. We have funded Viking stadiums and soccer stadiums and subsidized the owners of those teams with our general fund. We are going to be passing, I have no doubt, a tax decrease for everybody on Social Security this year. So every retiree, whether they make $150,000 or whether they make $50,000, I imagine we're going to, and we have in the past, although it didn't become law, passed tax cuts for people on Social Security, which is using our general fund to help those groups. And I would just say that there are very few groups of people in Minnesota to whom we have a bigger debt of gratitude than the firefighters and the police officers who have put their lives on the line for over 20 years, every single one of these men and women, to keep us safe, and for their spouses who every day said goodbye to their husbands, generally, not knowing if they were going to be coming back. You know, there's very few people we owe a greater debt of gratitude to. So if we're willing to give a tax cut to everybody with Social Security and give the owners of the Vikings a huge subsidy for their team, I don't think it's asking that much to ask for $1 million a year for the next 10 years out of a $45 billion budget to make sure that those officers and firefighters and their widows can live out their final years in dignity and security. And so that is what the bill is about, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thiessen, you know this issue very well. You're very passionate about it. You could have gone all night without saying the Vikings twice.
I voted for it too, Madam Chair.
The Viking Stadium twice. Representative Thiessen, we have the 1A amendment. Would you like to move that, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's a technical amendment, which I think there was just two numbers that were right. Reversed. So if we could do that, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Absolutely. All those in favor of the 1A amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, discussion, questions for Representative Thiessen before we bring up Mr. Anderson? Okay. Mr. Anderson, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association. Pairs Board has not taken a formal position on this bill, and generally speaking, if it's any change that would involve a benefit increase for a select group of members, they would want to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. I do think the LCPR staff memo does a very good job of outlining all the different policy decisions that are involved in this case. I would note that I think that for our board, the kind of the main issues would be the setting of a precedent for benefit increases that other employees may also seek, and the reversing of irrevocable and informed decisions. So those are two key items. And I'd like to elaborate a little bit on what is in the board, on the LCPR staff memo about just benefit equity. Just generally speaking, that the benefits that are currently available in this plan are tied to a member's service and their salary at retirement and the form of election of survivor coverage that they have. And using this approach helps create equity among the members. This bill would introduce a minimum benefit level that is not directly correlated to those components. That can create some benefit amount disparity or inequity between members, which can cause some concern. Second point is related to providing a benefit that's not available to all members. So this is a minimum benefit that's provided to a select group. So it's provided to members that came in through consolidation, but not to members who are not part of the consolidation. And lastly, this is a benefit intended to provide a minimum amount of income. To the extent that it's intended for that purpose, it's not entirely clear that what other income these eligible members might be eligible to receive, whether that's from Social Security from their employment or from other sources or from other plans, and we do know that some of the members that are eligible under these provisions are also receiving a benefit from some other plans within the state. the staff memo addressed that there need to be an update on some of the projected funding impact, and Representative Thiessen updated some of that, but I would like to reference the handout and walk through a few points here. First, talking a little bit about the members. So this is on page 2. The attempt here was to break this down, first talk about the surviving spouse component, and then talk about the retiree and disabled retiree component on the next page. But for surviving spouses, there would be 260 eligible members to receive an increase, and broke that down between those that are within 20% of the proposed $30,000 cap and those that are more than 20% from the proposed cap. So you can get a sense of what the current average benefit is for these groups and what the proposed average benefit would go to. Based on this data, which is data as of March 2017, we would estimate that the cost of this change for survivor benefits would be $6.1 million. Of concern, though, is the amount of members that are not part of the consolidated member group, and the note on the bottom of the page, which says that the non-consolidated survivors who are under $30,000 currently, there's over 400 of these members. So if you subtract from the total number of survivors, there's 1,873 total survivors. If you subtract those that are part of the consolidated group, the 463, that leaves about 1,400 survivors, and identifying that about 400 of that 1,400 are under 30,000. And if that group were to be included with a minimum benefit as well, the cost most certainly would be much, much higher than the $6.1 million for this group that's identified. And in total, just the average survivor benefit for the non-consolidated members is, we're showing the total for the entire group of $30,921. If you look at just for the consolidated members, it's $29,248, which would mean that the total for the non-consolidated group would also be very close to that number. So in aggregate terms, looking at an average across the board of all the survivors, the benefits are fairly comparable as is. On page 3 is similar data for retired and disabled members. And we did note here that we were assuming all members have more than 20 years of service, and Representative Thiessen confirmed that if that's due to vesting, a requirement to have 20 years of vesting, then indeed each of these would have over 20 years. The total cost related to this group of potentially 72 members would be a present value increase of $1.9 million. So while it's a smaller group than the survivor group, it's generally a younger group, providing a larger overall cost. And there's also concern here about the non-consolidated group, and actually more of a considerably larger potential. We didn't actually run the numbers, but if you look at the size of the non-consolidated group, which is over about 7,500 members, there certainly would be some members there, too, that would be under the 38,000 proposed cap. So we could see a significant number of members included if it was also considered appropriate to include non-consolidated members, which would be the board's concern. And I don't have the benefit of a lot of history here working on this plan, but if I just look at the total average benefit here for the non-consolidated members, which would be under the $52,000 if you take out the weighting, versus the average member for the consolidated members of $60,000, I don't think I would be able to conclude that the consolidated members have had a lower benefit amounts in general than the non-consolidated members. Page 4 just summarizes again the costs that I mentioned for the consolidated members that are included in this study. $6.1 million for the survivors, $1,850,000 for the retirees and disabled. If this is amortized to create 10 equal annual payments, which is a different approach than is typically used for funding, which is done as a level percent of pay. But if these are 10 equal annual payments paid at the beginning of each year, July 1st, the annual state contribution would be $1,080,000. And this is a para estimate. To get a more reliable estimate, we'd have to go to a qualified actuary to make sure we're validating these numbers. And a concern that exists here. I know the intent of the bill is to fully fund the entire benefit over the 10-year period, but that's not how actuarial math works, and it's not how accounting works, too. So I kind of classify these as reporting type issues, in that when the actuary does the next valuation, that if this bill were passed and the $7.9 or $8 million liability were realized, it would be included as a liability in the valuation, but the assets would not be included. They cannot be included until they're actually contributed to the plan. So it would create an unfunded liability in the valuation. Now, to be truthful, that's in the middle of a valuation report, and it'd be hard to notice given the size or the magnitude. But where it'd be more transparent would be in how the accounting numbers work. This is the government accounting standards, number 67 and 68. And what we would see here is, an example of this is on page 5, but it's a similar concept to the actuarial evaluation in that because these are benefits tied entirely to past service, the entire present value of the liability would show up as a line item called change in benefit terms. So on page 5, this is an example of the total plan GASB reporting for the police and fire plan and how that changed for fiscal year 16. So if this bill were passed in fiscal year 17, they'd be accounting for all the changes in liability, and where you see that red line that says changes in benefit terms, you would see a positive number there, meaning an increase in liability, whereas on the right-hand side, you would not see a corresponding asset. And so this is information that the entire liability gets allocated to the 450 so employers that are in the police and fire plan. They all would be allocated a component. And while the amount would be small, all 450 employers would see this cost as a benefit increase to the plan, which I think becomes somewhat interesting because we have a sustainability measure for the police and fire plan that, if successful, will help put the plan on the track to improve its funded status. But that, too, wouldn't show any change here. So while there's efforts made to improve the plan, the way the accounting works with the transparency, all that would show up here is an increase in benefit amount, and it would only be gradually that you would see the assets increase over time. On a final note, I would just say that administratively, the timeline is a little challenging to be able to implement this if passed by July 1st. These are old records, and we don't have everything on immediate file. I'd have to go back and ensure we are understanding exactly who is eligible, confirming that, and being careful to make sure that any changes are made appropriately. So July 1st would be a challenging deadline. We also would want to get confirmation of the actual dollar amount. So if there could be consideration of that as well, it would be appreciated. I think with that, I'd just like to comment with the LCPR staff memo. I think it does a very good job of summarizing all the policy issues, of which I think there are many here. And I would be happy to help answer any questions about any information that I've added.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, can you just review quickly again for the Commission the employing entities that were covered on here? Is it one community? Is it a number of communities?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, if you have your report that was done by PARA, let me see here. If you look at Appendix 3, it will list out the multiple, goes on for 2.5 pages of relief associations and employing entities. So the City of Albert Lea, City of Anoka, City of Austin, City of Bloomington, City of Brainerd, Chisholm, Columbia Heights, Crookston, Crystal, Duluth, Fairmont, Faribault, Fridley, Hibbing, Mankato, Minneapolis, New Ulm, but Minneapolis does not really apply, nor does Fairmont, because we've taken care of them more recently. New Ulm, Red Wing, Richfield, Rochester, South St. Paul, St. Cloud, St. Louis Park, St. Paul, Virginia, West St. Paul, and Winona.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
When we talk about the equity on this, one of the things that Representative Thiessen had talked about is it's far-reaching across the state, and compensation for employees performing the police and fire services are at a different rate as negotiated or as paid by their employing entities to the employees. Representative Thiessen, would you see that some individuals, if we adjusted the way that your bill is talking about, might be enriched compared to some of the other based on wages and anticipated benefits when they were being accrued to how those benefits are being paid out or proposed to be paid out under the confines of your bill?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So most of these local plans, their benefit increases were pegged to the salary of, I don't know, the highest level patrol officer for police officers and firefighters of the first class for firefighters, whatever that city negotiated with that fire department. So their benefits kind of were tied to the benefits of to the active members, which is very different than parapolice and fire did it. And they would have come up with different, that would have been different because it would depend on what contract was negotiated in each city for those salaries. So that is true. But I would also say that this commission and this legislature has already set a precedent to not take that into account when we essentially gave state aid to all of these cities to bring them into the fund, whatever their liability was. So we've already crossed that Rubicon. I don't see that that's really an issue anymore.
Chair.
Senator Thiessen.
O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll.
Thiessen, Thiessen, O'Driscoll. Representative Thiessen, to that point, I'll ask Mr. Anderson this. The anticipated 1% COLA that's available on this, does the sum of money, well, there are COLA adjustments, yes or no, on the benefits that are in question here.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, the post-retirement adjustment of 1% would apply on all these benefits.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. So how does PARA account for the floor going up and being able to deal with the COLA increases? Is that anticipated to be in the $8 million that would be paid over a period of time that Representative Thiessen is talking about, or does that actually complicate the actuarial and accounting equation?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the 1% post-retirement adjustment was incorporated into all these cost figures.
Representative O'Driscoll.
That's all I have for right now.
Okay. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, you had mentioned earlier that the Social Security benefits for survivors, that there's the potential that some of the survivors actually do receive Social Security benefits because they had other jobs outside of, separate from what their spouse had. Do you have any idea how many had Social Security benefits? Is that something that we can gather data-wise? Or
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we do not have access to that data. What we do know for some of the members is that we can identify that they may have participation in another plan, but we would not have any knowledge of their Social Security amount.
Representative Thiessen?
Just to that point, unless they worked at another job, but from their firefighting or police service, they did not qualify for Social Security benefits because they all are pre-1980 folks.
Representative Anderson.
And Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Thiessen. I was speaking more to the survivors, and assuming that some of them obviously had jobs that were outside of police and fire. So I was just curious how many of them actually received Social Security benefits. And I don't know if that's data that you're able to collect. Mr. Anderson said that would be hard to gather. But I do think, Mr. Anderson, if you can get the data on what other plans they have available to them, I think that would be helpful. And Representative Thiessen, if you have any comments on the Social Security piece, that would be helpful too.
Representative Anderson, I think there's a lot of data that still needs to be collected on this, too. Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, and I don't have all that data, although I would say for a lot of these, just as a generational matter, I would, and just my own experience with at least the Minneapolis and police and fire folks that we've worked with a lot, would not think that many of those spouses would have actually worked. That would just be my instinct on that, but I don't have any data on that.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Anderson. It's my understanding that when these plans consolidated, that the members of the plans had an option to elect how they'd like to have their pensions calculated, either under the former local plan or under the new plan they're emerging with. Is that correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dames, that is correct. That's my understanding.
Senator Dames.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. So then these folks actually made this decision as to which way they wanted to go.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dames, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wouldn't dispute that, although this was from 1987 until 2009, there were three or four major changes in how this worked and decision points all along the way. And I would also point out, particularly for the surviving widows, that even though the retirees had a choice, and this is that quote from the report that I came back to, even though the retirees had a choice, most of them without actually having to consult with their wives, but they had a choice to go with PARA or to the local plan for their retirement benefits. But once they died, we did not give these widows a choice about what their retirement would be. So once the spouse died, and I will get to one qualification of that, but once the spouse died, the widow's pension fell back to what it would have been under the local plan. And that's why you went from $5,000 a month to $1,800 a month. So we actually did not give the surviving spouses a choice of these plans, which I think which we could do now. There was an option to elect a different joint survivor option in 2000, which many of these folks elected, but it is still leaving them far behind where they would have been had they been able to actually follow through with the PARA post fund increases.
Thank you, Peterson, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious, so I'm new to this committee as well, but I keep on talking about these payments that were made in the 90s that kind of threw everything awry. I mean, is this part of, were these plans, some of those plans that were contributed to that?
Representative Thiessen.
What happened in the 90s is the stock market was great, and so benefit increases, we put benefit increases in place for people in PARA, police, and fire. So not these people, but everybody else. Everybody that was in PARA, police, and fire got the benefit of those benefit increases because the stock market was doing so well and we were over 100% funded. So some of the discrepancy that we've seen in these plans is because in these local plans, which weren't tied to the COLAs and all these benefit increases, but were matched to just the salary increases at the local level, didn't see those. And it's particularly important, again, for the widows, because when they got people even that opted into police and fire as PARA police and fire as a retiree, under the law that we passed, they got the benefit of all those increases. So they were getting up to $50,000, $5,000 a month. But when when the retiree died and it came back to the spouse, they dropped down. They lost all the benefit that they would have accrued over those over the 90s and the benefit increases that came along with that good stock market. So that, to me, is the biggest inequity in all of this. I mean, there's a lot of inequity in this, but that piece, I think, is the biggest one of all because those surviving spouses did not have a choice under the rules that this legislature set up when we did this, and we did not. I think that was a wrong decision by this legislature.
Representative Peterson. Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, I do agree with part of the assertion that at the time that this was going on, that perhaps the employee signed off and said, this is what I want, and spouses weren't consulted on that. And clearly that has a consequence. And I think that the legislature recognized it over time and put in place that both spouses, the employing spouse and the potential surviving spouse, have to sign off. Do you want a survivor benefit? Do you want a 50% survivor benefit? How do you want those to be taken care of? Where I really end up having a philosophical argument with myself on this is, if we treat this group this way, what about all the other people before we had that law in place that are in MSRS, that are in TRA, that are in PERA General, and all of the other plans? Do we, if I could use the term, do we get to hit the start over button for some of those folks who might not have had, who would have the same assertion that you're putting forward for this smaller group of people?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Driscoll, I don't think that the reason we should do this is because they couldn't sign off or not. I just think that that's context to keep in mind for this. The reason we should do this is because we have these inequities built into where we are. These people did a lot of service, and the spouses, even if they would have been able to sign off, they couldn't because they weren't given the choice. I mean, that's the point I'm trying to make here. So once their husband, for the most part, died, they, under state law, dropped back to this much lower pension. That's a decision we made. They couldn't have made that decision, and I think that's a big part of what we should rectify with this bill. I think there's a fundamental unfairness just with that decision we made 15, 20 years ago that we should fix in this bill. And that's the biggest part of the cost. I mean, you can see the biggest part of the cost of this bill is the $6 million that is for the surviving spouses. And we really did not give them a choice.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, to that point, and again, I'm not familiar with the particulars in that plan. You certainly are more versed than probably most members of the commission are.
I have my little flow
chart. Oh, there you go.
Cheat sheet.
Which one is the phone a friend on there? So my assumption would be that when the employee goes to draw benefits, they would have been asked, check which box do you want. Do you want a sole employee benefit? Do you want a survivor benefit and the like? Was it automatically imputed in the plan at that time that there would be a survivor benefit? Or because there were so many different communities that had so many different plans that there's so many different options and there really is no uniformity in the system?
Yeah. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Well, I'll do my best on this one. And so for the local plans, they typically didn't have the benefit would kind of just continue. So there wasn't even a concept of a joint survivor benefit. In para, police, and fire, obviously there was, and they could have made that choice. But even if they went into para, police, and fire again, they wouldn't have had, these people wouldn't have had that choice because the statute said the survivor benefit, when they pass this in 87, the survivor benefit is to drop back to the local plan. So they couldn't have made that choice. That's the point I'm trying to make. Now, in 2000, we did give them an option of dropping their, doing kind of a joint survivorship on top of it, but it was a very small bump for those folks. And most people chose that, but they're still kind of in this world.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you remember last week, we talked about the volunteer fire departments and the ones that had joined the state plan, and there's still some out there that haven't. That is not dissimilar from this situation, where it's just another era. When I started on this committee, we would have frequent spouses coming to testify on two or three a month, or two or three every year, or four or eight, like we do with the individual cases, similar to the one we had tonight on IRAP, saying, I didn't get to choose. I did not know. And we've worked through that, and we don't have those very often anymore. And there's something else that happened at the time period that Representative Thiessen is talking about. And that was, there were local plans, and then there was the state plan. And there was this push to consolidation. And many of the people resisted that because they didn't know what consolidation would bring. But they knew the people that were managing their state plan or their local plan. And they were very loyal to their people that were managing the local plan or giving advice about the local plan. And some of the people that chose the local plans chose those plans because they knew the faces that were in the local plan, but they didn't know the faces that were in the plan in St. Paul or the board members that would be managing the plan in St. Paul. And so when you think about your local communities or your neighborhoods, who do you think of as perhaps most loyal and true? Of the workers, public workers in your neighborhoods. They're the people that work at the courthouse or the city hall or the police or the fire departments. And true patriots like they are to their local neighborhoods, many were more likely to choose the local plan than the consolidated, unknown state plans. And we can't measure that. It's not scientific. Look at how quiet it's gotten. But you know I'm right. You know that's true. You know the workers that you're working side by side with probably made the decision based on what they knew. And that's what Representative Thiessen is talking about. And they made what has turned out to be the wrong decision. And the least financial system of decision. And so we have the decision. Should we help them or not?
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Any further comments, questions? Representative Thiessen, final words?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Oh, you know what, Representative Thiessen, I think Mr. Rice wants to come up and just say a few things, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, representing the Minnesota Police Fraternal Association. That's a group of about 800 members of the Para Police and Fire Fund. They're retirees. They're primarily from Minneapolis, but they do have other groups. I think that Representative Murphy very eloquently explained the first category, and that would be members, those fire, police and fire who made the choice. I really do think that probably the most compelling case is for those widows, and those would be the, if you look, there's a, CARE has actually done an excellent job, and that would be the group that's in Appendix H that would show in which cities these 280 widows would be. I mean, they're probably 99% women. Their average age is probably in their 80s. You could tell that by looking at the life expectancy is portrayed here in all the cases. There's a number of people in Duluth, for example. And that number has only dropped a small amount because what I've learned in this business is when you're talking about pensions, the women are going to be the final recipients in most cases of these benefits. They're the largest number of as far as this cohort goes, and even in most cohorts. And you'll see that these numbers of, on these pensions are rather modest. And to that point, Representative Murphy's been on the commission the longest, and she would recall it wasn't that long ago that the pension commission changed the pension laws to actually require the sign-off of the spouse for all benefit elections. And this group did not have that option. As Representative Thiessen has explained, going back to the 87 law, the member was given a choice between the local plan or the PRA post-retirement options. Or if they were still active, they could have either kept the local plan or gone into PRA, and many of them went to the PRA model, high five and formula, and then had pensions, post-retirement adjustments based on para. But what the surviving spouses had was really no choice. The option was under law that you got the relief association benefit.
Okay.
And so that's where this biggest disparity gives. The PARA report points out a $5,000 pensioner and the widow falling down to $1,800 a month. I think if you looked at Appendix H and combined it with the earlier one, which is the colored version, which would be Appendix E, you'll still see some St. Paul police officers and firefighters that are retired that are some are getting close to $100,000 a year pensions. When they go, their widows are going to be brought back to a much, much lower amount. And I think that's where the harshness of that those consolidation laws fall in place. I know these there are several policy considerations that were made out. One is I do think that
Mr. Rice, I thought it was a few words.
All right, I'll just say that the biggest one is reversing. There was no option in terms of precedent for these women. I think that you're going to find that this is a fairly limited cohort of people that it would apply to. And I do think it's probably just a matter of equity for the commission to look at to see if there's any relief that can be granted to these groups. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rice. Before we get to Representative Thiessen, Mr. Anderson, do you have anything, any comments to that or anything that you would like to say?
Madam Chair, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions on that? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thanks for taking so much time with this. You know, just a couple of the things. I do think that if you're talking about inequities here, I mean, there is an inequity that exists here between people that did the same kind of service, you know, and worked over 20 years, who are getting, you know, substantially different benefits, and particularly the widows, the surviving spouses. You can look at the numbers in the PARA packet, and you can see the retirees are not that much different, but there is an inequity that exists there as well. So that's the first thing. The second thing is important to acknowledge. There will be no impact on PARA ultimately, you know, if we keep the 10-year, if we fund this correctly. And we are going to have to get the right actuarial work before we figure out exactly what that number is. But if it's in the range of $8 million, you know, that's $1 million a year that we would do for this. And I would just note on this accounting statement, I mean, the PARA is correct that it would add this line, change in benefit terms. I would just note that that XXX line would say 8. So it would move this 11,111,000 to 11,111,008. So just in the scope of things, I mean, it will show up on the reports. But it's, you know, it's not even a rounding error. It's you know, infinitesimal. So that, I think, is important to know. The PARA will be held funded. We're not setting new precedent here. And I think that's really important because with these consolidations, we have put millions and millions and millions of dollars of state aid to help these local cities come into PARA fully funded. Which is basically the same thing as compensating, you know, providing state aid to pay. I mean, what we're asking here now, to provide state aid to pay for these benefits. That's what it's all about. And the state aid that we put in before was less than it would have been had everybody actually been in PARA, police, and fire, had they not been in these local plans, because the local plans were less. So essentially what we're doing is just doing the final piece of finishing this job. The last piece I want to say, there are these other folks out there that are making less than this minimum benefit amount that were in PARA, police, and fire after 1980. I don't know how many years those folks served. We know that these people will all have served 20 years. at least. That's something we may have to look at in the future. I imagine many of them, because of their lower benefit amounts, actually didn't put in 20 years, and that's why their pension benefit is less than the number we're setting forth in this. If that's something we need to look at in the future, we can, but that is not part of this bill, and I don't think we're setting any precedent in this bill for that, because they received the same pension benefits as everybody else in para, police, and fire. There's no differential here. They just got a lesser amount, probably because they put in less time. So I just think that there's a fairness to this. I don't think that we're setting up any precedent. I think we have a good argument around that. And especially for these widows who are receiving substantially less, both than in some cases they received when their husband was alive. And at the end of the day, because you know, these people did incredible service to our state. And you know, in my book, even if you set all the rest of this aside, as I said before, you know, they should be able to retire, you know, in their communities with dignity and security instead of having to worry about this. And I think what this bill does is allow these couple hundred of people, I mean, it's not that many people, but for them, this is really, really important. And I think it's the right kind of honor that we ought to give to them. So I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Well, members, I would suggest that we do lay this over because there is some work that needs to be done. Representative Thiessen, and you referred to it, the actuarial correct numbers, I think. I think there needs to be a vote on the board on that. We need to get the right numbers as far as how many survivors we are talking about. And plus, we are not nailed into our pension targets yet. But if we lay it over, it still keeps it alive. We aren't taking a vote on it tonight, if that's okay with you. Thoughts to that? Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Appreciate it.
Hey, and Madam Chair, I'm going to run out here. But can I just ask a question, not on this bill? With the budget targets that came out, can we pass a pension bill?
Well, we have a long session to go. And I am finance chair, and I am very happy to have the gavel for pensions, so it is a priority, and I know it's a priority for the House, too.
Well, can I ask Representative Driscoll the same thing? I mean, there's no money, or Representative Anderson, I suppose, there's no money in their targets for pensions. Representative Anderson has a negative $90 million target. What's the plan? I mean, should this commission just kind of do these local bills and go home?
Representative, who would like to take that? Representative Thiessen, I think that, as you know this game very well, this is a dance. And pensions is a priority, as I said. I think in the end, you know, we will be taking care of pensions. But if, you know, we don't have any room for your bill right here, if this is... you know, if we are on a limited pension target, so
I'm sure Representative Anderson could find $1 million for this bill.
Well, we have some other priorities too that do have board votes, and do have their numbers in play. But you need to have a little faith in the system, Representative Thiessen. You've been around the block as long as I have.
And Madam Chair, I don't. I know that none of this is real until May. I get that, but. If we don't have any money, the governor can't pass a pension bill. We have to have some money somewhere to actually get a pension bill off the floors until we can start negotiating it. And so I actually don't know how this is going to play out.
I'd like to answer that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, as you know, we gave the governor a pension bill last year, and he vetoed it, a very broad, bipartisan bill, and he flat-out vetoed it. And so... you know, if we're talking about what's going to happen, we don't know what's going to happen, and this is all part of the legislative process. We have several months to go, and hopefully you'll have conversations with the governor that when we are putting things forward that he'll be supportive of our efforts as well.
And, Madam Chair, just recall that the reason he vetoed it is because we put no money into the bill.
Okay. So with that, we're going to lay this over, and we have got a non-action item, which is Ms. Kim Crockett.
Welcome.
Good evening.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett. I thought this was going to go a little faster tonight, so I'm a little surprised, and my apologies. If you'd like to start, or if you want to, we can push on to next week, or if you'd like to do your presentation tonight, that would be great also.
I would like to present this evening, if that's all right with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And you know how much I love pensions and the Pension Commission, so I'm very happy to be here. I'm Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment. Here in my capacity as a senior policy fellow there, and I brought a friend of mine, Ross Bowen, who is an actuary, to help us along with any questions that you might have. You've got a couple of handouts from me. One is a PowerPoint. We don't have a projector, so we'll just walk through it together. And I will try to move through this very quickly with the promise that I will come and see any of you in your office anytime to explain the numbers. And there is also my 2015 pension blueprint, just to give you some of the background, though the numbers haven't been updated to this year's valuations. So very quickly, you have been talking about various ways this session to address issues within the defined benefit system and the plans. I'm not here to do that tonight. I'm here to give you a bigger picture and information to kind of put all of that into context, if you will. The title of my blueprint study is Keeping the Promise, and that is the goal that has animated me for 6 years as we've gotten to know one another over time. I hope that my presentation to you is helpful in seeking solutions. I am not an actuary or an economist, but I did bring an actuary with me because I need their help in noodling some of the hard details here. The numbers you're going to see tonight are from the valuation reports that are online with the Pension Commission, reflecting 2016 numbers or the most recent valuations. So the center didn't come up with the data. All we did is take it and load it into Excel spreadsheets to create what I hope, again, are helpful charts and graphs in order to talk about pensions. In a short presentation, we combined all the funds into this report, but I do have separate reports for each of the funds, TRA, St. Paul, PARA, MSRS, and so forth, if you want them. So just very quickly, let's turn to the PowerPoint that you have, and I think that there are copies available for folks who are here in the audience. And I'm just going to walk you through Keeping the Promise, Pensions 2017. So who is counting on us? Well, some of them are sitting right behind me tonight, which is great. We have over 318,000 public employees in the system, local, county, and statewide. About 311,000 people, retirees, survivors, and disabled folks who are counting on this pension commission and the legislature to keep the promise. That's 11.5% of Minnesota's population. So this is a very big deal. Turning to figure one, this page, scope of the problem. Let me just walk you through a little bit of history and how Minnesota has been making promises without paying for them. And let me just say, because somebody tweeted something out tonight about my appearance here, my goal is to make sure that anybody who's in a defined benefit plan right now sees that plan fully funded. Let me repeat that. I want to see it fully funded. And the state of Minnesota has not been doing that anywhere between the last 12 and 15 years. And that's why we've got a problem. So if you look at figure one, this shows the actuarial data starting in the year 2000 through last year. And you can see that we started out fully funded back in the early 2000s, and we've been dropping ever since. The low point, of course, coming after that massive market correction we experienced. We've been kind of hanging out in the low 70s, mid-70s. If you look at all the funds, But again, it varies on whether or not you're talking about TRA or MSRS. But basically, system-wide, we've got about 75 cents on the dollar to pay the benefit and a $17.8 billion shortfall as of last year. Now, if you turn to figure two, talking about, again, the scope of the problem, this is where it shows how we are borrowing from the future. We are borrowing from current employees, young ones, future employees, and our kids. So look at that $17.8 billion shortfall at the current assumptions of 8 to 8.5%. You'll remember, for those of you who've been around for a while, that our state economist came and we were over in the state office building, and she said, you know, you might want to consider some other discount rates when you're trying to figure out how short the funds are. And she gave the commission a range, anywhere from a 6.7% all the way down to like a 2% discount rate. And Mr. Bowen can talk about discount rates and risk rates and what that means, but it's essentially how you figure out what the liability is. So you can see how a $17, $18 billion shortfall can very quickly become a $45 billion shortfall if you're using accurate assumptions. And by falling short, we call it kicking the can down the road. But what it really is borrowing money from our kids. That's how I think of it. Shifting over to figure three, the next page, Warren Buffett calls pension promises a gigantic financial tapeworm. And the reason why he characterized it that way is that it's a tapeworm inside the system that just eats away at pension assets. And we can actually never really hit where we need to be. If you look at the blue line on the top, those are that's the pension promise that's been made, the accrued liability. The orange line underneath it that was running alongside underneath it are the assets that we have that Mansco Perry is taking care of at SBI. As you'll see, those two lines are not set up to meet. They did back in 2000, but they're going down the road this way, away from each other. The gray little mountain underneath is my way of trying to show that cash funding that Representative Thiessen was talking about, as well as other direct state aid. And then the orange little kind of cap on the mountain are additional employer contributions. So that gives you an idea of how much money is going into the system, and yet look at how the liability and the assets aren't meeting. In other words, it's not working. So if you turn to figure four, you can see there's a circle, a blue and yellow circle. So last year, the normal costs were about $1.5 billion on the system. On top of that, all plans paid in almost $1 billion toward the unfunded liability, the amortized unfunded liability. And you can see in those squares how that was split between employees and employers. And again, it varies depending on whether you're in police and fire or TRA on what that split is. So we're in a pretty good-sized hole. And that's why when you read, you know, the actuarial reports, and I know you all go home at night and read them. I'm just joking. If you ever need to get to sleep, it'll help. But this is the kind of quote that'll keep you awake at night. An infinite number of years would be required to eliminate the unfunded liability. In other words, it says the unfunded liability will never be eliminated. These are the actuaries writing warning signals to us in the system. Do you remember early in the session you had actuaries come and explain some of these things to you? Well, it's my job to kind of reinforce that message tonight. So remember, about $1 billion went toward the unfunded liability last year, and about that amount, I imagine, this year. What else would that buy? And I apologize, Chair Rosen, but I'm afraid the Viking Stadium's going to come up again in my PowerPoint. What would $1 billion buy is my question. It would buy a lot of roads, teacher salaries, Other things that local, county, and state government has as a priority, maybe even including a tax cut, it happened to equal about the cost of a stadium as well. Just to give
Ms.
you an
Crock,
idea,
I advise you not to bring up the
I apologize.
Stadium again.
I apologize. It was right there. I couldn't. I could have just zoomed right by it, but and I should have. So, just very quickly, I gave you in Figure 5. To show you how we are paying more, including our employees, but we're falling behind. It just shows you how, as a percent of payroll, contributions are going up, and yet we're not getting out of the hole. And I think Figure 6, if you can turn to that, is my favorite chart of all. And again, I have one for each plan. Starting in the early 2000s, we were showing as fully funded throughout the system. And each plan differs as to when the amount it was supposed to pay in and the amount it actually paid in began to split. So the blue line shows the total requirements that your actuaries told you you had to pay in order to be fully funded again, to keep that promise. And then the orange bar are the actual contributions that were made. And as you can see from this chart, the state of Minnesota, throughout the system, and county and local governments and school districts stopped paying the full amount. I don't know if it was a hangover from all those years of great returns, and we thought State Board of Investment was going to save us. I don't know where that came from, because that is not how we do things here in Minnesota. We are the good government state, right? But at some point, we fell away from those good practices. And for defined benefit systems, we began to fall into what I would call freak-out territory. When you drop below the 90s and you're getting into the 80s and the 70s, that's freak-out time, but we've been that frog in the boiling water. How did we get into this mess? Well, you've heard a lot about assumed rates of return and discount rates. Mansco Perry said something out loud that I thought was profound this session. He said, maybe those two ought to be calculated separately. I was thrilled, and I've written about that because he's right. And the public pension system in the United States does it very differently from the private sector system. So if you look at Figure 7, you'll see that Minnesota, in assuming 8 and 8.5% returns, is an outlier. And we've been an outlier since I started looking at this about 6 years ago. We've kind of slowly put our toe in the water to drop down. I know that the governor has recommended an immediate drop this session, but that would still be playing catch up. I just want you to know that what this shows is that most funds around the United States are now at 7.5% or lower. This is data from NASRA. So they keep track of what all the public pension funds are doing around the country. Quickly moving on to fixing the problem. The legislature fixed some of those post-fund problems that were referred to earlier tonight. You passed very difficult sustainability measures in 2010, and you've done some other ones since. Although the plans wanted you to believe that the market crash caused the problems, as I think you can see from the data tonight, that is simply not true, that the bad habits began several years before that crash occurred. We have relied on getting solid returns from State Board of Investment, but it's not closing the gap, right? So what are the consequences, quickly in reviewing? We are crowding out spending and priorities elsewhere throughout the system. We are increasingly borrowing from our future, but also bringing scrutiny from Moody's, Standard and Poor's, rating agencies. The cost of borrowing is actually going to go up as our pension liabilities increase, because they are looking at that very closely now, especially Moody's. And because we have stayed at that high assumed rate of return, we are putting our assets in a very volatile portfolio mix and thus putting them at risk. All of this hurts job creation, both in the public sector, where we might want to hire more teachers, more police officers, more MnDOT workers, and we just don't have the funds to do it because employees are expensive and we're paying down that unfunded liability. So what's a solution? We want to look for something that's transparent, affordable, predictable, and again, fully funded. Fully funded. And that's what the promise should be, and that's how it should be kept. All the stakeholders need to be involved. I'm just going to zoom ahead because it's so late. So what do I recommend? And this is a topic that must be taken up with great seriousness and spend a lot of time on it. And tonight's probably not the night. But just to wrap things up and also see if Mr. Bowen can add something and answer any questions. The recommendation is please fully fund your current promises. There's a state surplus, supposedly. No, there isn't. Pensions are off the books. And if you included pensions in your calculations, there would not be a surplus now or any time in the future. Representative Thiessen made a suggestion, I think, last year. Why don't we put some of the so-called surplus toward the required contribution this year? Start over. Get those good habits back in place so that the budget is dedicated toward these types of promises and our public employees. Next, and here's the big bombshell, close these plans. Close the defined benefit plans and figure out a way to calculate honestly what we're short so we can figure out a way to fund it fully. And it took us a long time to get into a hole, and it's going to take us even longer probably to get out of it. Now, why would you close the defined benefit plans? Well, first of all, because then you stop adding new liabilities into the system.
Ms. Crockett.
Yes.
Your last statement, I'm on your...
This? Oh, you're reading that?
Yes, and on page 12, it has your recommendations. It doesn't say anything, as far as I can tell, about closing the defined benefits. Is
yeah.
that in there?
Well, when it says, no, it's not. It's in here. This is 2015. This is 2017. But I'm happy to get you an update of that if you'd like it. We just got a phone call last night to be here tonight instead of next week, so we didn't have a chance to update this.
Okay.
But I actually made a point of updating the PowerPoint so it would be in there. That's very controversial. It's a difficult decision, one not to be taken lightly. And frankly, this commission and the legislature would have to spend many, many years trying to figure that out and relying on a lot of smart people and conscientious people to do that honestly and do that carefully. You would want to offer then to new employees a defined contribution plan with all the bells and whistles that MNSCU and other public employees currently enjoy and really, really love. I think there's about $6.5 billion in assets right now in defined contribution plans under management at State Board of Investment. Young people coming into the system are going to be very mobile. We were talking earlier tonight about the difference between generations years ago and how you could assume, for example, that women might not have been working and all of that. This has all changed, and a defined contribution plan actually is something that I think is much more appealing to our younger employees, and owning your own assets, certainly not getting into this kind of problem. Frankly, if I was a young employee coming in and looking at the numbers, I'd want to have a DC over a DB. So that's just kind of the overview. I'm not here to fix the defined benefit system. I do have a few recommendations. For example, I'm looking very hard at COLAs because it eats away at the asset base. It's a very generous approach that you won't find in the private sector, for example. If Minnesota really took this on, Minnesota would be a leader, and frankly, it would be the hardest thing the state has ever done. So with that, I'm going to conclude my very, very rapid remarks, recognizing the lateness of the evening, and very quickly turn it over to Mr. Bowen here, who is an actuary.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. If you could pull your microphone, that's great. And please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ross Bowen. I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, and I have over 30 years of experience with annuities and pensions. I'm actually married to a teacher, and we are counting on her TRA benefit for her retirement benefit as part of our financial plan. But I'm also here because I'm an engaged citizen who happens to know quite a bit about pensions. I've read these actuarial valuations, and they did not put me to sleep. In fact, they made me very alarmed. As I read through it, I looked at the assumptions, and there's standard assumptions about mortality or length of service, which didn't strike me as anything unusual. But the discount rate is very striking, and it's critical to what the valuation of your liability is and how much we actually owe. The two observations about that are it's very high. The expected return is very high for a balanced and prudent portfolio. And number two, what's odd is that the valuation of the liability depends on the invested asset rate. That only happens in state and government pensions. In the private world, nothing like that is in existence, so this is a unique situation. When an insurance company finds the value of the reserve that they have to hold for their liability, it doesn't have anything to do with the underlying assets. And as I read this, I feel that the valuation is too low, which means that we actually owe a lot more than these statements say. Valuations are just estimates. And in fact, for each plan, there's actually two reports, one the regular report and one by GASB, and they each have different valuations that are billions of dollars different. Let me give an example of your home. So you live in a house, and you think, well, how much is my house worth? Well, you know what you paid for it. You know what you've put into it. You see the assessed value, and you know what, perhaps you know what your neighbor's house went for down the street. But you'll never know what your house is worth until you actually go to sell it. And that made me ponder this about our liability. And in fact, we could sell our liability, and this would give us a different value, right? And we could take a different perspective. If we sell a liability, it's kind of odd. When you sell someone a liability, you have to give them money, as opposed to when you buy an asset, you give, you know, you money exchanges the other way. If we were to sell our assets to an insurer, which we could, and we could get rid of our liability, the state, the Minnesota state actually sets a different discount rate for insurance companies, and that rate's 4% for a liability like this, as opposed to the 8.5% that we use for our pensions here. And so what I've done is, using these reports, I've estimated the value of the liability using a discount rate of 4%, which would be approximately what we could sell this for. Right now we have assets of $48 billion, and these reports show that our liabilities are $66 billion, so we're $18 billion short. But if we sold it, I think we would need to pay the insurers $110 billion at a 4% discount rate. If you subtract our $48 billion in assets from there, I'd say we actually need $62 billion. And I was doing a thought experiment about that. How would you come up with $62 billion? Well, you could raise property taxes by 75% for 10 years, just to put a framework on how big a number that is. I doubt we're going to be able to do that. So I'm afraid we're fooling ourselves with these valuations, and I see ourselves is on a 12-step plan, and we're still on step one, where we haven't really recognized what a serious problem that we have. I certainly understand the appeal of business as usual and incrementalism in dealing with the problem, but I don't believe that's going to work, not in the long term. And my thoughts and my ideas here I'm sharing with you to hope that you can share my alarm and hopefully take more action to fully fund these liabilities. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Any questions for Mr. Bowen or Ms. Crockett? Well, thank you very much. Any final words?
No, thank you so much. And yeah, we're happy to come back anytime, and wish we could have come in earlier in the evening and caught everybody, but we're available.
Absolutely, and we will be bringing you back up. But, yeah, it's very heavy, very kind of depressing news. The numbers are real, and we appreciate that. Members, next
thank
week.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Crockett, Mr. Bone. Next week, we have a few more bills that we're going to be working on, and hopefully we'll start at 5:30 again with that. Representative Murphy. Yes. Yes. Yes, thank you. With that, meeting is adjourned. So next would be